Good morning. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call this remote meeting of the House Preventing Homelessness Division to order. The committee legislative assistant will take the roll to determine which members are present.
Chair Gomez.
Present.
Gomez present. Keeler.
Keeler present.
Keeler present. New Brindley.
Present.
New Brindley present. Davids.
Davids present.
David's present. Heinrich.
Heinrich present.
Heinrich present. Hollins.
Hollins present.
Hollins present. Hornstein.
Hornstein present.
Hornstein present. Howard. Cagle.
Present.
Cagle present. Petersburg.
Present.
Petersburg present. Ryer.
Ryer present.
Ryer present. And we do have a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Petrie. Next, if we could have a motion to approve the minutes for February 24th, 2021.
Madam Chair, I'll move those minutes.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. Vice Chair Keeler moves approval of the minutes for February 24th, 2021. Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, if we could unmute for a moment, we're going to do a quick voice vote. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes for February 24th, 2021 are adopted. So thank you, members. We're going to get right into our the topics before us today. We have a lot of testifiers on the line who want to talk about the bill that we're going to hear later in the committee. First, we're going to hear from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. The MDVA has made great strides over the past decade on veterans homelessness, and they're here to share more about their program in the hopes that it can inform our work, not just with veterans, but with other populations as well. The bill that we'll be hearing later is the Housing First for Kids Tax Aid. And, you know, as we're thinking about that program, I want us to absorb what the MDVA shares with us and think about, again, like if there are applications to other populations that we want to target. So leading us off, we have Paul Williams, who's the Homeless Program Supervisor at MDVA. Mr. Williams, if you could please introduce yourself and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Gomez and committee members. I'm Paul Williams, Homeless Program Supervisor for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. It's an honor to be with you this morning to speak with you a little bit about our ongoing efforts to end veteran homelessness in Minnesota, as well as highlight some of the successes and key lessons that we've learned throughout our work. We have a presentation for you this morning, and so if you're able to hold your questions until the end, it might be the best approach just to give us a chance to get through the information we'd like to share with you this morning. With me today are Sloan Kessler, who's the Homeless Programs Coordinator with the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. And we've also asked John Lovold from the Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans, the largest nonprofit in the state, doing the work to end veteran homelessness, to join us as well. MACV also administers the Supportive Services for Veteran Families federal grant in Minnesota and are one of our closest partners. And as you'll see throughout this presentation, these partnerships are critical to the successes that we've seen. So with that, I'd like to get started with providing you with a brief overview of our mission and what it means to end veteran homelessness. So six of the 10 continuums of care in Minnesota have declared a functional end to veteran homelessness. So Minnesota, as you may or may not know, is comprised of 10 regionally split up continuums. Six of the 10 have declared there's four remaining. There's Hennepin, County, Ramsey County, Central, and St. Louis County. But a federal review team comprised of the United States Interagency Council on Homelessness, Housing and Urban Development, and the federal VA have reviewed these communities' systems and deemed that they have effectively ended veteran homelessness and have the systems in place to rapidly house a veteran who experiences a housing crisis in the future. And so I think it's important, again, to just understand that it doesn't mean that there's not currently a veteran experiencing homelessness in this area or that there won't be in the future, but that when a veteran does experience a housing crisis, that it's rare, that it's brief, and that it doesn't reoccur, so that that veteran isn't recycling back into homelessness. The MDVA's goal is to find safe, stable housing for all veterans experiencing homelessness in Minnesota, and to receive that statewide declaration from that federal review team to become the fourth state in the country to receive that distinction. So once we do get the final four COCs to reach that milestone, there will be a statewide review by that same federal review team. Next slide, thanks. I'll cover briefly just kind of how the program got started and how the effort got started at MDVA. And then kind of where we're at now after the growth. So it started in 2010 as kind of an ancillary meeting on the commissioner's schedule. But in 2014, MDVA contracted to bring on a homeless program coordinator. Later in that year, the Homeless Veteran Registry was established. This is really one of the focal points in the effort was this creation of this statewide master by name list. We weren't the first state to do it. I believe New York had a statewide registry to really understand exactly how many people and veterans were experiencing homelessness, but we were one of the first. And since that time, it's really been seen widely as a national best practice to really provide a census and to understand name by name how many people are experiencing this issue. It does a few things, right? It allows us to focus on the individual and come up with individualized housing plans and approaches. It allows us to better understand the scope of the work that's needed. And then it helped us really coordinate and align with partners in a way that we weren't able and that wasn't being done prior. So better understanding overlap in services from different organizations serving homeless veterans, and then also identify gaps that existed where we weren't reaching veterans who were experiencing housing crises. And then in 2016, the Veteran SOAR program was created. Now, what this does is it connects at-risk veterans and veterans who are experiencing homelessness with Social Security disability benefits and kind of help them navigate that difficult process. And this is really seen as one of our prevention efforts, right? If we can help address further upstream someone's income issue or what have you, we can prevent them from being added to the Homeless Veteran Registry. We expanded the initiative side of our work through the Star of the North Fellowship Program. So for 2 years in a row, we brought on Star of the North Fellows, and they were subsequently hired as Homeless Program Coordinators. And then the Homeless Program Supervisor position was created as well. And then last year, we expanded to a total of four Homeless Programs Coordinators, all that have they do very similar work, but all have their certain areas of responsibility to kind of push the effort. Next slide. Briefly toot our own horn here a little bit, only insofar as I think it demonstrates some of the successes and how, some of the partnerships and things that we've done really have led to successes and we think are transferable to other subpopulations. So in fiscal year 20, over $2 million were received in federal benefits for veterans that were assisted through the MDVA's Veteran SOAR program. Again, those are those Social Security disability benefits. Since the registry was launched at the end of 2014, over 2,200 veterans who were experiencing homelessness have found safe, stable housing through the registry process. And we did reach a high watermark in fiscal year 20 at 550 veterans, the most in any year. Registry 2.0 was launched in July of 2019 and greatly increased our capacity to collect data. So just collecting so much more information that really does a few really critical key things, and namely, the reliance on quality data. When you have quality data, your asks are so much more well received. You have different ways to splice the data to say, all right, we can key in on just what the issue is we're experiencing in this area, which may look different than another continuum of care. So just really has been a benefit to us. What it did was we built a public facing dashboard, which is available, and you'll see a screenshot of that in the next slide. But it really has done a couple things too. It increased the data literacy surrounding the issue of homeless veterans in Minnesota, and then it really increased our transparency. So everybody can see our progress and our goals. They can look at their own continuum of care within their own part of the state. And I think it's just a really big piece to the puzzle. And when we go to leadership and we say, hey, we really need this, we have the data to support, it's so much more than anecdotal. Another important piece was this mobile application. So we had tried for a couple of years to get this mobile application, but because of COVID, it made it much more relevant in that because of the limited number of outreach workers, we could quickly, with a cell phone or a tablet, if you came across a veteran who's experiencing a housing crisis and their intent was to join the registry, they could quickly be added via a verbal attestation. So another important thing to come from that registry 2.0. And then MDVA really does view our work to end veteran homelessness as potentially serving as a roadmap for other subpopulations. So while we understand there's uniqueness within each subpopulation and the same resources for veterans may not exist, a lot of the lessons that we've learned can still be transferable. And so MDVA is a proud member and an active member with the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness team and those agencies, and just really proud of the work we've done. And so with that, I'd like to turn it over to Sloan Kessler.
Chair Gomez and committee members, thank you so much for having me here this morning. My name is Sloan Kessler, and I am a homeless programs coordinator with the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Before I dive right into the data that you see here on your screen, I want to first acknowledge John Lovald from the Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans, who's also joined us in this testimony this morning. We have all of this real-time data to show you right here, right now, because of our strong partnership with MACV, our partners at the federal VA, and dozens of partners across the state that do this day-to-day work of ensuring that the data is accurate and real-time. So as you can all see here, we're very focused on how to use data to drive results and decisions. On the right side of the screen is our public-facing dashboard, which Paul just kind of described for you. And it's available on our website and updated daily to really promote transparency and usability for all of our partners across the state that do this work. We capture certain data points like shelter status of veterans, VA or SSVF eligibility status, and all-time data trends to really kind of help us determine where there are adjustments that might need to be made. And since the Homeless Veteran Registry launched in 2014, we've housed, as Paul said, over 2,200 veterans. The graph on the left kind of helps illustrate this a little bit. At one point, the newly identified veterans peaked at 594. And at that point in time, the focus in the very early parts of this effort were making sure that that we were compiling a list, a very complete list, and not duplicating efforts or duplicating the work that was being done, but also trying to make sure that that list was very comprehensive. We've now seen that number in newly identified veterans drop to as low as 382 veterans in a year. And in 2019, we housed 538 veterans, which was the highest in our history on the registry. And that does not include an individual that might have had multiple housing outcomes in a year. So there is a little bit of a caveat there that data is unique to each individual veteran. Next slide, please. I do want to discuss briefly a few of our current and ongoing efforts that have allowed us and our partners to continue to succeed in doing this work. We've identified a continued gap in landlords renting or frankly, not renting to veterans, especially those that might be experiencing high barriers to housing. And so we created a program, an internal program, to help mitigate and incentivize costs for landlords. So there are three funds that are available. There's an incentive fund, the vacancy relief fund, and the risk mitigation fund that are available to landlords to kind of help bridge that gap. We're also focusing a lot of our energy right now using the data that we have on demographics to address disparities in the veteran homeless response system. We're in the process of standing up a diversity, equity, and inclusion work group across the state through this effort. In addition, we're also seeking to continue learning and innovating through a national organization, Community Solutions, where we can really problem solve with other communities and share best practices across the country. That's a really important part of this work, is learning from other communities that are also doing this work. Through this partnership, we recently received an $100,000 donation from Chase Bank, which was in part because of our continuous investment in showing high quality data. And we were able to hire a full-time employee at Guild, a local nonprofit, and that person will be helping connect our non-VA eligible veterans to the mainstream resources that they might be eligible for. And lastly, we've got some legislative proposals that we're currently working on. First is a proposal to provide non-VA eligible veterans with housing vouchers and wraparound services. And then the second is a policy proposal to codify existing practices within the homeless programs team and language that will help us more quickly and efficiently serve veterans that are experiencing homelessness. So now for probably the most important part of the presentation is our lessons learned and our key takeaways from doing this work thus far. As Paul had previously mentioned, it's really crucial to have a master by name list to understand the scope of the effort first and to collect data to rapidly inform the next step, the next decision, the next course of action that we want to take. We do bi-weekly case conferencing of the entire list, and that's very crucial for developing individualized housing plans for each veteran that's experiencing homelessness that's on that list. And we can really accomplish actual coordination around individual veterans' care and finding paths back to housing with the key partners that we have that are sitting around the same table every 2 weeks at that time doing that work together. Another really key takeaway is seeking and building and maintaining partnerships. It's a crucial element for the success of the effort. We're always looking to demonstrate the value of the Homeless Veteran Registry and that entire process, but at the same time, looking for others to do the same to help us in this kind of two-way partnership. We're continuously developing new partnerships to aid in the process of connecting veterans with the resources that they need, and really trying to make sure that we have a complete table of partners that will be there to help. Something that we've learned along the way with this work specifically is that someone should be owning the effort. And what I mean by that is it might come in the form of a single organization, or it might come in the form of a small group of highly invested collaborators that have the same mission moving forward. But the ownership piece helps drive that momentum and drive that work forward so that it can continue to evolve and grow. With our veterans work, we're very lucky to have our Veteran Corps collaborative partners, MACV and the VA, who share the same mission with us in ending veteran homelessness. And what we can do together is align our goals, align our resources, and continue to push that momentum forward and take the time to step back and realign when that's needed. And then another very key takeaway is that there must be continued investment and innovation to be successful. We've internally adopted a motto that's fail fast and fail forward. And that allows us to continue to try new things and to really adapt if something doesn't work. We can adjust and adapt and try something different and see how it works and then continue that process. We also really, as Paul had mentioned with the launching of Registry 2.0, we're trying as hard as we can to continue to invest in our data because it's crucial to ensuring that all of our decisions are grounded in the reality of what's happening right now and what's happening in the veteran homeless response system, in the homeless response system as a whole. And through new tools like the public facing dashboard, we can promote that transparency and really highlight the increased data literacy that shows that high quality data is a priority for us and for all of our partners. So that's the end of the presentation. Paul and John Lowvald and myself are available to answer any questions that you all may have. I see that we might have a few to start. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for joining us and for your presentation. So just so members know, we have about 19 minutes on this topic. I have Representatives Davids, New Brindley, and Keeler on in queue. Please raise your hands if you have questions. We'll go first to Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the testimony from Ms. Kessler. I did have a question, something she said. She said that they're talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion. So it brings the question up to me is, why are we dividing veterans? Why are we dividing veterans by race? A veteran's a veteran. I really don't care what color they are or what race they are. I could care less. If it's a veteran, it's a veteran. Why is the department dividing veterans that are homeless into diversity, equity, and inclusion? They're veterans.
Chair Gomez, Representative. What we've realized as we've started to collect this data is that there are disparities even within our veteran response to time it takes for a veteran to be housed based off of some of the demographic information that we've found. Who it is that we're seeing is becoming homeless is we have disparities in that data as it is. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to address that. We're trying to make that as within the veteran population, something that is very equitable moving forward. Because what we're seeing is right now there are inequities within just the veteran world. Not only that, but homelessness in general. So we've tried to really hone in on what we're seeing and how we can improve on that.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And really, that's quite shameful. I'm very saddened to hear that that's the case. A veteran is a veteran. To say that there's a Black veteran, a white veteran, an Asian veteran, and there's differences, that's just shameful. And this had better be taken care of very quickly. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Davids. I guess I would draw our attention to the map that Eric Grumdahl shared with us in one of our first committee meetings that controlled for income and talked about the disparity in homelessness, experiences of unsheltered homelessness, especially for Native people and Black people in our state. And I personally, I appreciate the VA for identifying that as an issue and recognizing that in their own work that they were less able to serve certain populations. When we disaggregate data, then we can better target our interventions. And so, I think that's kind of the approach, and I appreciate that. So thank you for your question, Representative Davids. Next, Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for the presentation. This was really enlightening and really interesting. I have two questions if I can. The first is on one of your very first slides, you said 6 of the 10 continuums of care have declared a functional end to veteran homelessness, which is remarkable. But I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about what does the continuums of care mean? And what do we mean when we say 6 of the 10 of those have a functional end to homelessness?
Mr. Williams or Ms. Kessler, I'm not sure who that should go to. Also, yeah, that term really confused me when I had them present this to me, so I'm glad you're asking this. Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Williams.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Good question, Representative. And the key really is it's broken down that way, and it's sort of mandated by HUD for the homeless response system. So they can look at a very regional, individualized approach for the resources that are needed for that specific area. And then each area is kind of made up of its own governing board and operation board, things like that. But really, they each kind of come up with, you know, how when an individual enters into homelessness or experiences a housing crisis within that area, how they're going to get connected to the greater amount of services that are available. And then, you know, continually monitor their census in an annual point in time count. And then based on that information, they can ask for federal resources. That's kind of broken up regionally that way, if that makes sense.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Williams. So just to make sure I'm clear, are we saying that it's geographic areas that are monitored?
Mr. Williams?
That's correct, Chair, Representative. Yeah, so they're broken up regionally, yep.
Okay.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. I mean, with the map, that was what my assumption was, but calling it continuums of care, I wasn't quite sure. I guess then my as a follow-up to this one, because I do have one more, but as a follow-up to this question, I would, what are the most significant roadblocks you're running into in the remaining four that have not been able to declare that functional end to homelessness?
Mr. Williams?
Yeah, Chair Gomez, Representative, another great question. So what we see is as we get lower and lower on the number of veterans, we have veterans with increased barriers. So more veterans experiencing chronic homelessness that kind of keep reentering homelessness. We see, you know, historically low rental vacancy rates. So trying to be creative in ways to free up units for veterans to rent. There's just a myriad of different reasons. The pandemic has highlighted as well some of the issues we've had in getting veterans, you know, things like the eviction moratorium. Just a lot of different barriers. But as we see, we get lower and lower and closer to our goal, just finding units for veterans, and then just addressing and really what Registry 2.0 has allowed us to do is better understand the specific nature of the barriers that these veterans are experiencing. And so, you know, whether it's eviction history, things like that, we can better come up with specific programming and approaches based on what we know of their barriers to address those issues and continue to try to find them housing.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Williams. I really appreciate that, and it's logical, right? As there are as you serve more people and the population that is still homeless shrinks, it's logical that those folks would have greater barriers. So that makes perfect sense. My next question is further down on the current and ongoing efforts. You talked about the barriers with housing availability and landlords being hesitant to rent to our homeless veterans. I attended the opening of a new veterans home in North St. Paul this summer that I know MACV was really involved in. And we had this conversation there. So this is really interesting to me. And you talked about how you've created an incentive fund, a vacancy relief fund, and a risk mitigation fund. And I'm wondering how those function in practice. How do those function, and how do you interface with landlords with this kind of stuff?
Mr. Williams. Go ahead, Mr. Williams.
Sure. So could I ask you to just briefly repeat the question? I apologize. I couldn't hear about half of what you were saying. I apologize.
Yeah, go ahead, Ms. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize. I'm looking at the current and ongoing efforts and particularly the programs involving landlords, the incentive fund, the vacancy relief fund, and the risk mitigation fund. And I'm wondering how those, how do those function in practice, and how are you interacting with landlords? And maybe Ms. Kessler, I know this was part of her part of the presentation. I'm not sure which of you would be more appropriate to answer that.
Thank you. Yeah, go ahead, whoever's in line to answer.
Chair Gomez and Representative, I think I probably can answer this a little bit more thoroughly at this point in time. So the three different funds that we're referring to, like as you said, we're really talking and targeting veterans that have high barriers with these funding sources, because we understand that sometimes landlords, because they have the opportunity to generally work with whomever they want, might not be as excited when a veteran might apply for a unit and they find different barriers or what have you in their background. And so the risk mitigation, I'll start with the incentive fund. The incentive fund operates, there's a $1,000 one-time payment for a qualifying veteran that moves into housing from our homeless veteran registry. So that means that individual has a level of high barrier and the landlord can apply directly to our in-house operation of that fund. The second fund is the vacancy relief fund, and that offers up to a landlord for a qualifying veteran up to 1 month's worth of rent, because we understand that a lot of our veterans are moving into HUDVASH units or Section 8 units, and the inspection period might take two to three weeks of additional time that a landlord might be losing out on rent if they were renting to someone else. And so we want to make them whole by offering this vacancy relief fund. And then the final fund is the risk mitigation fund, which operates essentially as insurance policy. So it's a $2,000 payment beyond a security deposit to a landlord if there are certain criteria that are met. But if for some reason their unit is left in a condition in which the security deposit wouldn't cover the remaining kind of balance it might take to repair the unit. So those are the three funds that are available currently. And what we do to operationalize that fund is we have staff that work with landlords every day. And they are there to kind of play that intermediary role to sign landlords up for this program, to make sure that they're working side by side with the landlord partners, and to make sure that it's a seamless process for the veteran and for the landlord that are enrolling in the program.
Thank you, Ms. Kessler. Representative New Brindley.
Excellent. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it.
Great. Thanks so much. Next is Vice Chair Keeler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I want to say, as we enter into this conversation or have entered, to all the veterans out there who are either on this committee, in the community, or who's listening to this, thank you so much for your service. I come from many generations of military individuals, and I know the sacrifice that not only you make, but your families do as well, so I don't want this opportunity to pass without saying thank you. One thing I did want to bring up, just as we were talking about data and diversity and inclusion, one thing that we know is that our minority veterans by percent tend to see more combat, but then they also come back into the communities with less mental health support and possibly higher PTSD outcomes. And we know from all the stories that we've heard, those are some of the combinations that lead to homelessness and unsheltered spaces. So I just wanted to say that as part of the reason why it's important that we look at this data. But I wanna ask a question that hasn't been brought up, because this committee is preventing homelessness. And one of the things I know from my grandpa to my dad to other people in my family, we were able to get into homes because as they served, they had access to VA certified or subsidized home loans. And so I know we didn't really talk about that, but could you share some data with us on how many of our veterans come back and utilize that service and how we're doing outreach and supporting our veterans to get into homes, sustainable homes, as the prevention homelessness piece. If you don't have it now, that's fine, but I would really like to follow up and have some of that data and further conversation.
Mr. Williams or Ms. Kessler? Maybe that's a follow-up.
Yeah,
piece
Chair.
Of it.
Chair, Representative, good question. We don't have that information available now. I don't know, John, if you have any insights into that, but we can certainly look into that for you.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Vice Chair Keeler, did you have anything further?
No, thank you. But I do think that as we're looking, you know, again, through the lens of prevention, I would really like to have that data and maybe find a time to have some follow-up information on how well we're doing that outreach and maybe what role that could play in this. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Keeler. Representative Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the testifiers. Just a quick comment and a question. I really found the takeaway section really helpful in thinking not just about how we're succeeding in this arena, but how we should be sort of looking at a whole broad array of issues, whether it's the housing or other issues. In particular, the concept of failing forward and or failing fast and failing forward. I feel like sometimes organizationally or in government, failure sometimes feels more like slowly sinking in quicksand. And so I appreciate that sort of mindset. And my question, comment and a question related to the really important takeaway of combining investment and innovation. And I was really struck by how you combine those two concepts. I feel like often at the legislature, we look at those two as an either or proposition. You know, sometimes there's discussion of innovation, more of a concept of trying to be creative with limited resources. But my question to the testifiers, to Mr. William or Ms. Kessler, is could the innovation that has helped make such an impact be possible without the investment? Or do you find that the two are necessary together, the investment and the innovation that you're moving forward with?
Mr. Williams, I know this is Ms. Kessler's slide, but you probably all have thoughts about that. Important question.
Yeah, Chair Gomez, good question, Representative. And I would say I think the impact of and just how innovative you can be is directly related to the amount of investment that's made. We've had a very supportive agency in really attacking this critical issue, and it's made it one of its priorities from the commissioner to the governor. And so there's been an influx of investment. We saw it with Registry 2.0, and so many things have kind of blossomed from that and come from that, where Sloan spoke about that $100,000 grant from Chase Bank. Without the data that we took from Registry 2.0, we wouldn't have received that money, and that's not state money. That's finding ways to be innovative and collaborating with groups across the country in order to kind of maximize how we're able to be innovative, and then looking at best practices always and what level we can kind of incorporate that into our work. And maybe it doesn't transfer, you know, line by line from what was done in another community, but how we can tweak it to make it work for the system that we have in place. And Sloan, I don't know if you have any other additional thoughts on that.
Ms. Kessler, we have a minute left if you want to share anything else.
Sure, Chair. And Representative, that is a really wonderful question. And I think it begs the entire group to think about, you know, where do those two things line up together? And I think something that's been very clear in doing this work is once we can prove with the evidence and the implementation of the innovation at that time, that it works and that good things are happening and there's a continual moving forward, the investment can then be the next step. And it's just the cycle of, you know, using the innovation in the sphere that you have it, and then implementing that, continuing to show that the investments are needed, as and then, you know, allowing that sphere to grow. So it's kind of both, but showing through what you can using innovation, I think, is a really key piece of the work that we've been able to do to gain more investment into kind of moving forward.
Thank you, Ms. Kessler. Anything else, Representative Howard?
Nope, thanks, Madam Chair.
Great, with that, we will thank the amazing staff from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs for being with us today. You know, when we met together, I think we were supposed to meet for like half an hour and we met for like over an hour. So I think, you know, after deadline, if members want, maybe we could get together and have kind of a more in-depth conversation because there's really a lot for us to learn from the work that you presented today. So thank you so much for being here. With that, I'm going to hand the fake gavel over to Vice Chair Keeler, or the fake real gavel, virtual gavel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Finally on the agenda, we have House File 1791. This bill was referred to the division by the chair of the full committee, Representative Schultz. Chair Gomez, would you like to move your bill?
I would, Madam Chair.
We have House File 1791 before us. We will have the author introduce her bill, followed by testimony and on the bill itself, and then we will hear amendments and member discussion. Just for a timestamp, we have about 50 minutes for this. We're hoping to end right at noon. Chair Gomez, please present your bill to the committee.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House File 1791, the Housing First for Kids Local Aid, takes a big step to address an issue that impacts families and communities across the state, child homelessness. Many, if not maybe all of us are parents, all the members on here, I don't know. I don't know if Representative Petersburg has kids, but we were all parented, right? So I'm thinking about the kind of basics of parenting, which are like keeping your kids warm, making sure that they're safe from harm, making sure they have healthy food and like that they drink enough water and sleep enough, wash their hands after they eat, you know, getting them up in the morning and getting them dressed and off to school. And, you know, I want us as parents or as people who were parented to imagine what it's like to try to make those basic things happen if you were sleeping in a car with your kids, or if you were staying in a friend's living room and your kids were sleeping on the floor, or if you were in a shelter. You know, trying to figure out, like, are you going to go without utilities because you can't afford all the bills on the salary that you make? You know, having to decide what you're going to forego each month to keep your kids housed and fed. This is the reality for thousands of families across the state each year. And the cost of inadequate action on child homelessness, action that doesn't meet the scale of the problem, is simply too high. This cost shows up in many places in our systems, in opportunity gaps in our schools, utilization of public services, and in the human cost. I was so shocked to read this Wilder data that 1/3 of those who are homeless in Minnesota during their point in time count are children under the age of 17 living with parents, which of course is disproportionate to their percentage of the population. Another thing from that Wilder research that struck me was that half of adults who they surveyed who were homeless first became homeless by the time they were age 24, and 1/3 of homeless adults had been homeless with their parents when they were under age 18. So when we talk about preventing homelessness, I believe it's clear that keeping the youngest and most vulnerable in our state stably housed with their families, making sure that they do not fall off that cliff into homelessness when they're under 18, while they're still in our schools, is one of the best targeted interventions that we can do. With the Housing First for Kids Local Aid, I'm proposing that we take bold action to do for school-age kids what we've done for veterans, to come together across party lines to say that we as a society will simply not accept in a prosperous state in the richest country that's ever existed that children are going without a safe place to lay their heads at night. The presentation that we saw from the Department of Veterans Affairs has showed us that a housing first model and a shared effort that's targeted can make episodes of homelessness rare, brief, and non-reoccurring. Housing First is a homelessness approach that prioritizes providing permanent housing to people experiencing homelessness or keeping people in their permanent housing as a way to prevent homelessness. You know, giving them a platform from which they can pursue personal goals and improve their quality of life. The Housing First approach views housing as the foundation for life.
It's not one size fits all. It's tailored to the needs of the individual families. So this aid would, it's a local aid to counties that would help the families of up to 10,000 students each year who are or who are in danger of experiencing homelessness. While this funding isn't going to Minnesota Housing's Homework Starts with Homes program, which you'll hear a lot about later, we modeled the approach on that program. So that's kind of why the testimony is focused on that program that's kind of rolling and that we have information about. So I just want to walk us briefly through the bill before we turn to the testifiers. Subdivision 2 establishes the program's purpose, providing aid to local governments to help ensure that kids are not homeless. Subdivision 3 speaks to the allocation of the funds. So, the Commissioner of Revenue will allocate money to counties based on each county's percentage of students experiencing homelessness based on MDE, Minnesota Department of Education data. Subdivision 4 is sort of the meat of the bill that talks about how the funds are to be used. You can kind of read through them. The programs are targeting families with children who are in pre-K through grade 12 and, either are experiencing, lacking a fixed, regular, and adequate nighttime residence, which is sort of the language from the from Homework Starts with Home, or if they're in overcrowded conditions in their current housing and it's cost burdened. Similar to kind of the VA approach that we just heard about, sort of the kind of bedrock of this program is about providing rental assistance and support case management services that the families need. Subdivision 5 talks about how and when the allocation to the counties will be made. This is through the Department of Revenue, and they're going to calculate the county aid based on the data that they receive from MDE. The appropriation is $110 million in fiscal year 22-23. And so that's kind of the sort of outline of the bill. We're going to hear from a few testifiers. Just want to walk you really quick through the testimony that we're going to offer. First, we're joined by Dr. Ann Mastin of the University of Minnesota, and Dr. Mastin's going to help ground us in the research about child homelessness and the connection to development and academic achievement. Next, we'll hear from Minnesota Housing Assistant Commissioner Ryan Bontrag for information about Homework Starts with Home and the data that he has about sort of the scale of the problem and what our response has been. We're then going to hear from Sonia Wadina, who is the Indian Education Coordinator in Bemidji, where there's a Homework Starts with Home program site. And finally, from Dominique Perkins, who is a St. Paul Promise neighborhood parent. And with that, Madam Chair, we could go to my testifiers.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. We will start with Dr. Ann Mastin. If you can please state your name and organization title for the record, please.
I'm Ann Mastin. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota. And I'm honored to be here. I've been asked to share some of highlights of what we know about risk and resilience in homeless children in families and homeless youth on their own. What I wanted to begin with is the point that these families are at very high risk. The parents who have been studied, who end up experiencing homelessness, often have a very long history of chronic adversity dating back to their childhood. Many of you have probably heard of ACEs, the measure of adverse childhood experiences. We conduct that measurement in our state as well. But they have a history of deep poverty. We are now realizing that we see intergenerational homelessness, so that when you help parents and children, you're also preventing homelessness in another generation. We also have collected data to illustrate how high the risk level is of these parents. Here's data from a study where we asked the Quest ACE measure to parents staying in a shelter in Minnesota. And then we compared it to the national data the CDC collects. And we also compared it to our own state data from 2011 on adverse childhood experiences. And you have a handout of these slides, but I just wanted to say that you can look down here and see that in many kinds of childhood experiences, parents who are currently homeless have much higher rates of traumatic life experiences. And that's an important thing to know for what kind of services they may need. For example, their own parents have often been incarcerated at a much higher rate than other families. They've often experienced maltreatment and neglect when they were children, and they often have also experienced homelessness of their own. We also know that the children and youth who end up experiencing homelessness, whether they're with their families or not, have very high risks, high levels of trauma experiences. They have often experienced family violence or separation from the family. They come from backgrounds of deep poverty. And what I think you can see on this list is that the children often share many of the adversities that their own parents experienced when they were children. And there are particular high-risk groups as well. We know that youth leaving foster care, making that transition, are particularly high risk for homelessness. And we know that children who experience homelessness have much more difficulty in school. They end up with many more health problems. They have mental health problems. And in many ways, their human capital for the future is affected, not just by the current crisis of homelessness, but by the history of adversity that many of these children have experienced. And of course, that has implications for our state in the future, because children who have these kind of risks and issues developing over time are going to be limited in their human capital development and in their future as part of our state and our workforce. You've already heard, I'm sure, in this committee about the Minnesota Department of Education data. As was pointed out in the first testimony about veterans, homeless students are much more at risk in terms of race and ethnicity. Black, Indigenous, and Hispanic students in Minnesota, as well as across the nation, are at much higher risk of being affected by homelessness than other students. And in some cases, this is extremely disproportional, as you can see on this graph from our own MDE data. I wanted to share these data with you. This is one of the most striking studies we've done on the risk for achievement in homeless students. These are data from a collaborative study with the Minneapolis Public Schools. They have a very high rate of homeless students over time. And these data are showing what happens in terms of reading achievement for all the kids who are tested in Minneapolis over a period of 5 years. And this is more than 26,000 students represented here. And what we're charting is their reading achievement over time. And we've divided the students into four groups. And the highest risk group on the chart are students who've experienced homelessness one or more times during this period of time that we did the study. And what is also striking is that in that district, 14% of all the students tested had experienced homelessness over the course of this 5 year period. And what you can see here is that they're at very high risk for achievement problems. They start off in the third grade at around the 12th percentile on average compared to nationwide average on this test. And we've also got on this chart a solid black line, which represents the national average. That's where you would like to have your students be, close to that line or above it. And what you can see here is that they're extremely low on reading achievement. And this, we observe the same thing in math. And they're significantly below the group of children who are living in poverty and qualified for free meals in the district, but are not in the homeless group. And that's a very large group in the Minneapolis Public Schools. 57% of all the kids who were tested were qualified for free meals. Their achievement is also very low, but what you can see here is that the homeless students are at much higher risk than even the kids living in poverty. They in math and reading is significantly below other children living in poverty. And you see up there in green, there's a dotted line for reduced kids with reduced price meals. These children have lower income, but you know they're qualified for reduced price meals because they're within 185% of the poverty line. That's a smaller percentage of kids in this district, 4%. And you'll notice that they track the national norm averages on this reading test. The depth of poverty does make a difference. And then what you see at the top are students, we've called them low risk in this graph, but what that really means is that simply students who were not identified as homeless or qualified for the National School Lunch Program at any time during this 5-year period. And you see that their achievement starts off at the 75th percentile and stays very high. And what you can see in this longitudinal story is that the kids who are experiencing homelessness never close the gap. This represents the infamous achievement gap we're struggling with in Minnesota, and homeless students are very high risk for this kind of achievement disparity. Now, what about protective factors? I've been involved in studying risk and resilience in children for a long time. And we have found protective factors for students who end up with better outcomes. And these protective factors will probably be familiar to you. We know that, you know, even if children are in a shelter, if they have really effective parents, they are more successful despite all the barriers. We know that students who have attendance problems are more likely to have achievement problems, but if they, you know, if we can increase their attendance and we can stabilize their schooling, students do better. And we know that being able to attend high quality preschools and schools make a difference. But the problem is for many of the homeless families that we study is that homelessness itself undermines many of the most important protective factors for child development. Now, in terms of housing interventions, the evidence, you know, is strongest in terms of intervention for families that are already homeless, that long-term housing subsidies make the most difference. And the most famous study is the Family Options Study, which found that housing vouchers not only reduce homelessness and food insecurity, but also decreased family separations, foster care, school mobility in the kids, also improved attendance, and also had spillover effects to the well-being of the families. In terms of preventing homelessness, which I know is the aim of this committee, the similar evidence supports housing subsidies. And in addition, some targeted efforts, for example, to prevent eviction through cash assistance or legal help and other strategies, community-based services tailored to need, which many of the programs across the state attempt to do, and targeting special populations, which may be pertinent to the first testimony we heard, that the young people leaving foster care at very high risk for becoming homeless parents down the road. So that's a special population that some have urged us to focus our attention on. And I'll just close and say that I'm very thrilled to be part of a Grand Challenge project that's been funded by the University of Minnesota to help the state learn and gain evidence from studying the effects of the Homework Starts with Home project on homeless students. And we formed a research partnership with Minnesota Housing, the Department of Education, and faculty at the university. We've assembled a huge data set at MinLink, Minnesota Linking Information for Children. And we are beginning to analyze the data to determine how effective the program has been in stabilizing families and promoting achievement in children. And I'll leave it at that because you're going to hear more about this program and see if there are any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Mastin, for that. Just as an announcement, with the virtual platform, we have to have a firm stop at 12, and so we will end testifying at 11:45. And to Representative Petersburg, we will be doing questions during discussion. So moving on to the next, we have Ryan Baumtrog. If you could please say your name and title organization for the record, please.
Great, thanks, Chair Keeler. I'm Ryan Baumtrog, Assistant Commissioner for Policy and Community Development at Minnesota Housing. Thanks for the opportunity to testify this morning about the governor's proposed increase in the Homework Starts with Home program, which as Representative Gomez mentioned, is the model for her legislation. I want to provide a little bit of background about Homework Starts with Home, and that starts with just a little bit of context that Minnesota Housing first received an appropriation from the legislature for the homeless and highly mobile students rental assistance pilot project back in 2013, a one-time appropriation of $2 million. And over the subsequent years, we were able to get additional one-time appropriations, but then just recently for fiscal years 2018 and 2019, the Homework Starts with Home program became part of the agency's budget, first at $2 million, then subsequently at $3.5 million. And then the governor is proposing a $1 million increase to that program for the next biennium to bring it to a total of $4.5 million. This is a program that's in collaboration with the Department of Education, the Office to Prevent and End Homelessness, as well as the philanthropic community. And as Professor Mastin walked through one of her slides, talked about housing subsidies, prevention efforts, and it being community-based. And those are very much principles of the Homework Starts with Home program. So this program, why it's important, in October of 2019, more than 9,000 children were identified as homeless or highly mobile in over 1,300 schools, 307 school districts, and 78 of Minnesota's 87 counties. This is a statewide issue. It is a significant issue. And as we know, many of those students could benefit from rental assistance and other supports through the Homework Starts with Home program. Minnesota Housing currently has 8 grantees that are operating the Homework Starts with Home program across the state in the Northwest region of the state, the West Central part of the state, Hennepin and Ramsey, as well as the Southeast part of the state, and then a few of the suburbs. These 8 grantees are estimated once they fully enroll families to be around 900 households. So just in context of what we're doing with the resources that have already been allocated, even at full scale, we estimate that about 900 households will be served through the resources that we've received already. Part of the Homework Starts with Home program is about community-based. Every grantee that Minnesota Housing has is works with partners in the community and then identified schools. And it's through the schools connection where families get identified for the program. So it is very community-based. And I know you will hear from one of our grantees later. So I will not go into a little bit of the program delivery, but the program is meant to be community-based, working with individual families and really right-sizing the amount of housing assistance that those families need to stabilize their housing situation. We did a program evaluation of the Homeless and Highly Mobile Students program, the first one that we got in 2013, and found very similar statistics to what Dr. Mattson just walk through. One thing that I'll point out is her slides mentioned deep housing subsidies. What we found with the Homework Starts with Home program is that for about $5,000 a year or $5,500, you can stabilize a family in their home. And then through the evaluation report that we found, in as little as 2 years, families can go from experiencing homelessness to become homeowners if they are given some assistance through rent assistance to help pay their rent. It's been quite a journey throughout COVID-19 for our partners to navigate and find families. It's been harder. The needs are significant and great, but finding the families that may be more doubled up through everything that schools are doing about work, you know, distance learning and things like that, it's been a challenge, but our grantees are navigating it throughout the state and doing as much online as they can. The population, in terms of who has been served in the last year, the annual household income, I had to look at this twice because it's so low. The annual household income for families served through the Homework Starts with Home program is $8,000, which is about 9% of this state median income. So $8,000 is the median income for families that participate in the Homework Starts with Home program. And the average amount of assistance is $5,500. And as I mentioned earlier, families go through a coordinated effort to determine what level of housing assistance do they need. Is it prevention to help keep them in their homes, or is it rental assistance to help pay either where they're currently living or find a more suitable place to live? So with that, I know you're scrunched on time, but happy to share more later.
Thank you, Mr. Baumchuk, for that. That was extremely helpful. We are running tight on time. And so the next two testifiers, if you can just do your best to keep it under 2 minutes, because we have a lot of information to still get through. Next on the list is Sonia Wadina. Please make sure you state your name and title for the record. Thank you.
Good morning, Representative Keeler and committee members. My name is Sonia Wadina. I'm the Indian Education Coordinator for Bemidji Area Schools in Northern Minnesota. And our school district makes up roughly 23% of American Indian population. American Indians within the state make up 1% of the population. So statistically, we're insignificant when it comes to data, but our challenges and experiences are not insignificant. And we recognize that here within our community, as they were writing the Homework Starts with Home grant, looking at local agencies identifying roughly 60% of the services that they're providing were for American Indians. So across the state, American Indians are disproportionately homeless, or as we prefer to say in our school, they're in transition, and in transition from one home to the next, or one situation to a new situation. So what we looked at, or as a result of the disproportionate number of American Indian children experiencing homelessness in our community, we find that it's extremely important for our Indian education program to work closely with our McKinney-Vento coordinator, as well as the local agencies such as BICAP, which is actually the fiscal agent for our Homework Starts with Home grant, to identify and meet the needs of the students, and that includes case management. We know that children do better academically and social emotionally, which leads to a decrease in disciplinary behaviors, and they don't have to wonder where they're sleeping at night. Or we've had students, you know, worried about their parents because they know that they don't have heat in their home. So they're sitting at school with this extra stress on them. So I feel strongly about giving people equal access to our basic needs and leveling the playing field for our students and families that need a boost or a hand up. We currently have 160 school-aged children identified in our McKinney-Vento program to date, and this number is actually down due to the challenge of identifying families during the pandemic. Within our current Homework Starts with Home partnership with BICAP, which is our community action program, and with Red Lake, Bemidji Area Schools has 21 families that are benefiting from the Homework Starts with Home. Each of those families have a minimum of 2 children in their home, so that's 42. If we just go with 2 per family, that's 42 children that are impacted by this grant. Again, it's the housing finance piece that goes with that, and the case management to support them to move off of homework, off of the subsidy. As a result of those 21 families, 15 of those families enrolled in the program last year and are in stable housing. and no longer qualify as under McKinney-Vento. Of those 15 families, they're adequately housed and they feel confident in that. And we're hopeful that they can maintain that stability for their students. We have an additional 5 families that have been housed this year under that program. And we have 1 family that is still awaiting housing. So this resource has helped stabilize many youth in our district and they can now focus again on their education. The funding has also prevented enrollment movement from within our school or moving to other neighboring schools or even out of state. It's allowed the children to remain in their home school in a stable setting, which will eliminate or has eliminated that typical 4 to 6 months of academic loss. So we find this to be beneficial and I encourage your support, continued support of this because these children are our future.
Thank you, Ms. Wadena. I have to say to you, I appreciate you and your work. Thank you. Next, we have Dominique Perkins. If you can make sure that we're on a time crunch, so try to keep it under 2 minutes. Please state your name and organization title for the record, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and community members, or committee members, I'm sorry. My name is Dominique Perkins, and this is my testimony.
Speak to me.
A young mother doing everything that I can, working 2 and 3 jobs, but still the odds are at hand. I get knocked at the door. My landlord let our house get foreclosed. The place me and my children have grown, they are not telling us we now have to go. I drop my head down to the floor. There is no hope. My mind is everywhere. How do I manage to cope? We have been homeless before. That's a place that no one wants to know. That's a place where no one wants to go. That's a place where we feel downright low. I have to give up everything. All our memories and dreams. We take what we can and leave the rest in between. I felt like I was losing my mind. I'm thankful to God that I have strong people by my side. I know that being strong is how I survive. So I went into a shelter. I had to swallow my pride. This stripped my children away from their structure, from their comfort, and how to deal with one another. Their behaviors changed. Their attitudes changed. They were failing in school. This added more stress to my pain.
Speak to me.
The school reached out and offered me support.
Speak to me.
I just wanted to be self-sufficient. I found out I was not by myself.
Speak
with programs that are out here to help families in need, it gives a struggling family a chance to believe. It gives a single mother and a father a chance to achieve.
Speak
making our dreams possible and overcoming many obstacles. Being able to afford housing makes a big difference. I am a better support to my children and I can provide for a living. Helping families with housing allows families to prosper and children to enhance. It gives a family an opportunity to not depend on anyone, but to lend a helping hand. Now I am working on owning my own business and creating a foundation. My children have structure and they're working on their education. These programs are important to creating a better society. That is why I'm here. And I thank you all entirely. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Ms. Perkins. There's been a lot of stories and testifiers that we have heard and that was extremely moving. Thank you for sharing that with us. We are going to move quickly to, we have 2 public testifiers that we're going to be able to get to today just to stay on track with time. Any of the other public testifiers that we were not able to get to, if you can please submit written testimony, we will get that out to our committee. So we are going to move to Commissioner Irene Fernando, just for the sake of time. Again, if we can keep it brief, preferably under 2 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thanks to Dominique for your powerful words. My name is Irene Fernando, Hennepin County Commissioner. Over the past year, I have personally observed youth and family homelessness grow dramatically in Hennepin. As a local elected, I partner with staff, community, and colleagues in a race against time to expand shelter capacity before the cold Minnesota winter. On the heels of that, and in my role as the vice chair of Association of Minnesota Counties Economic Development, Workforce, and Housing Committee, I'm incredibly appreciative of this bill, which recognizes homelessness as an issue in every county. The issue of homelessness does not occur in a vacuum of the metro. My commissioner colleagues across the state have expressed concern about the growing number of individuals and families experiencing homelessness in their counties. Homelessness and housing instability may take different forms across the state. In some instances, people may be staying in their cars or on couches of friends and loved ones in order to get a roof over their heads. Some migrate to the metro where resources may be more readily available. But in these instances, people and families are faced with the difficult reality that in order to seek a safe place to lay their heads at night, they must leave the support and connections of their home communities. As such, AMC has identified increasing resources for housing security and affordability as a statewide legislative priority this year. We support direct investments in prevention programs to address the growing crisis of homelessness across the state, such as rental assistance and foreclosure prevention. I know in previous committee hearings, members have heard from fellow county commissioners from St. Louis County, Olmsted, and even a commissioner who operates his own shelter in Beltrami. Homelessness is a Minnesota problem, and it requires a Minnesota solution. Every single person in our communities deserves and has earned the right for a safe, dignified, and reliable place to lay their heads each night. And this bill takes a big step towards addressing the poverty and housing insecurity that plagues so many of our state's children and families. In closing, thanks to the committee for your consideration, and special thanks to you, Representative Gomez, for your strong leadership. We look forward, as Hennepin and as AMC, to working with you directly to ensure that needs are met across the state with the necessary flexibility for each unique county. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Fernando. Next, we will move to Laura Birnbaum. Again, just for time, state your name, title, and try to keep it under 2 minutes. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Laura Birnbaum, and I work for St. Louis County Public Health and Human Services, supervising our housing and homelessness programs team, and I'm pleased and grateful to be with you this morning. Homelessness and housing instability continues to be a barrier with ever-shifting challenges for families and unaccompanied youth in Greater Minnesota. As of yesterday, in Duluth alone, 1,250 households on our coordinated entry system are on our coordinated entry system priority list. Our coordinated entry system is intended to match households experiencing homelessness with housing that meets their needs. Of these, 397 households have children, with 25 individuals being pregnant at the time of their assessment. An additional 29 households were pregnant also at the time of their assessment with no other children in the household. To illustrate that this is not just a Duluth issue, our largest city, in northern St. Louis County, 100 households are currently on our priority list. 22 of those households have children, with one of them pregnant at assessment. An additional 7 households were also pregnant at the time of assessment with no other children in the household. So this data is significant in itself, knowing that our priority lists do not capture every household that is experiencing homelessness or at risk of homelessness in our communities. We know that students may not report homelessness due to the stigma it carries and not wanting to be outed to their peers. We also know that parents may have fears of children being removed if they ask for help, all leading to the likelihood that the need is far underreported. The impact of youth and family homelessness is showing up in many places, including but not limited to truancy action projects, our crisis nursery, and supervised visitation programs. The issues that are presented here are rooted in experiencing homelessness and housing instability, often coupled with unmet mental and chemical health needs. In preparation for my time with you today, I reached out to many of our partner organizations across St. Louis County to hear from them directly. We have wonderful partners who are dedicated to the work and the youth and families that they serve. I felt it was really important for you to hear their perspectives as well, lifting up the voices of youth and families experiencing homelessness or at risk. These partners include Lutheran Social Services, Lifehouse, CHUM, specifically the Steve O'Neill Apartments, which is permanent supportive housing in Duluth, AOA, the Loaves and Fishes community, school social workers serving families in transition, and St. Louis County Children Mental Health Workers, all who provide a continuum of services and supports, including street outreach, supportive housing, emergency shelter, case management, and housing navigation support. I know we're on a time crunch, so I submitted this in writing as well, so you can see a much more detailed picture of some of the data and examples and illustrations. But what I would really like to highlight is, yes, we are seeing more families and unaccompanied youth experiencing homelessness across our county. But more specifically, we're seeing youth who are experiencing homelessness who are parents themselves and parenting multiple children. This creates significant barriers due to the lack of units that are adequate for larger families. And this is true throughout our communities. In short, the need for House File 1791 that is to become a bill is in St. Louis County is clear and with serious consequence. I'm excited about the potential that it has to become a bill, and I'm confident that the impact would be significant for families and youth facing homelessness due to our strong, dedicated, and innovative partner agencies and organizations. We have these already in place through various programs and grant work.
Ms. Birmhall, sorry, we need to move on. Sorry. Okay. Thank you for your time, and I know that you said you submitted something in writing.
We did.
Be sure to look over
that.
Thank
you so much. Thank you. Members,
we have a DE amendment labeled House File 1791 DE1. Who is offering this amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, if it's okay, Madam Chair, I spoke to the other Madam Chair this morning, and what I'd like to do, if it's okay, is I will just speak to this for a minute, and then I will withdraw. I won't offer the amendment. I know I spoke to the chair, and I know that she does not want to take the amendment today, but we will work on it moving forward. And so, first of all, I just want to say thank you to Representative Gomez for the bill. You know, we talked early on about identifying those populations where it's important to have the biggest impact, and we both agreed that that includes our kids, particularly. And to one of the testifiers, I mean, we talked about the impact on the disparities in education outcomes and all of these things. And so I really appreciate the goal of this bill. And my concern with voting for the bill in its current form is that there's still so much we don't know. I forwarded some bill language to Representative Gomez as well this morning to sort of get to the heart of that. But I'm concerned about starting a new, relatively expensive program in perpetuity without more information. And so the DE amendment actually takes Representative Gomez's language verbatim. I don't change that language. All we do is turn it into a pilot program for the next 2 years with a study at the end. And we cut back the funding just a little bit because of the cost of the program. I just think it's really critical. While certainly I support the investment, I'm concerned about starting that program in perpetuity without a report to the legislature, without knowing the success of what we're doing. So that was the intent behind the DE amendment, but I will withdraw that. And I would just ask, I just have one question about the bill, if I may quickly. We've talked about this on other bills as well that have come before the committee, and we've supported some legislation to help this. But one of the things this bill does is target, it says targeting of unaccompanied youth in need of an alternative residential setting. And I'm wondering if you can, if Representative Gomez or somebody else on the call could talk to that a little bit. I'm wondering, clearly there are services available, but I'm wondering, particularly when it comes to unaccompanied youth, how the system is sort of designed to function when it comes to youth. Clearly we have a foster system in the state, but are there ages at which we don't push kids back into the foster system and we support them in their own right? How does that function in practicality?
Okay, first, thank you, Representative New Brenly. I want to say I appreciate our committee and our active movement to work together. I just need to make the announcement that Representative New Brindley withdraws the DE amendment that we have before us in House File 1791. Now moving to the question, Chair Gomez, did you wanna respond, again, being mindful of how much time we have left?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I would ask Mr. Grumdahl or Commissioner Bontrag to speak to the to Representative New Brindley's question, if that's possible.
You're on mute.
Sorry about that. Madam Chair and Representative Gomez and Representative New Brindley, I think that question is a one that makes a lot of sense in this context and requires a pretty deep dive, so it's hard to answer succinctly. I think the short version is that, especially for older minors and for people, for youth over the age 18 and for older minors, often foster care-based solutions are not going to end up being the fastest or best option. And so what's really been created in a number of communities across the state is a partnership between homeless youth serving organizations and local child welfare agencies to determine kind of what's available or what's possible. That is a space that frankly could also use a lot of reinforcement and support, because often there aren't options available for those two entities, the homeless youth service community and the child welfare agency, to meaningfully draw from an option that's really youth-centered and able to respond to that individual youth's housing situation and need. And so there's a pilot program that the Interagency Council on Homelessness and DHS stood up with Hennepin County called Minor Connect, that was really focused exactly on that particular challenge of trying to find the right kind of housing solution for older minors. And so happy to do a deeper dive into just some of what that experience showed. I think what it really showed is that a child welfare solution or a homeless youth solution by themselves aren't as strong or as effective as having the two entities really partner together, but there's very rarely been the right kind of resources or support for that kind of partnership to occur. Minor Connect is kind of an exception in that way. And so the short answer is often there's not a great solution that's available in either system for those older minor youth right now.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative New Brindley. Representative Petersburg, I appreciate your patience. We've tried to get through a lot of information very quickly. We do need to do roll call in 1 minute. So can you ask your question or statement? And I think it's noted that we need to have a further conversation around this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the inquiry of Chair Gomez, I have a blended family of 8 children, 11 grandchildren, and 1 grandchild that's distance learning with me for a year. So I understand that part. My question is also around Representative New Brindley's concern about this program without any kind of analysis or reporting back. And I'm real concerned that we are putting together a program in which we are not going to know whether or not we're working. As we heard about the Veterans Affair, they started in 2014, and they're still making changes to the program. And so without that kind of direction and backup and follow up, I'm concerned that we may be putting forth a program that may not be very successful and just kind of running around in circles. And so that's my concern. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Chair Gomez, do you want to have a quick response? And then we do need to go to roll call.
I just would say that I'm very open to adding reporting mechanisms. So I'm going to be in touch with you guys about this. So thank you so much. Well, we should probably just go to the vote. I appreciate the great conversation today.
Hearing no further discussion, Chair Gomez will renew her motion that House File 1791 be returned to the full committee. Will the legislative assistant take the roll?
Chair Gomez.
Aye.
Chair Gomez, aye. Keeler.
Aye.
Keeler, aye. New Brindley.
No.
New Brindley, nay. Davids.
No.
Davids, nay. Heinrich.
No.
Heinrich, nay. Hollins.
Aye.
Hollins, aye. Hornstein.
Aye.
Hornstein, aye. Howard.
Aye.
Howard, aye. Cagle?
Aye.
Cagle, aye. Petersburg?
No.
Petersburg, nay. Ryer?
Aye.
Ryer, aye. There are 7 ayes and 4 nays.
With that, the motion passes and House File 1791 is referred to the full committee. It is noon. We did it. With that, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.